Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
And it is another edition of Hoops Adjacent. I am David Aldridge in L.A. My man, Waz Lambre. What's up, man?
I'm good. I'm just cooling, man. Just cooling. The weather, the temperature's rising again. Allergy season is back, but, you know, I'm cooling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Last week was horrible for me with the allergies here in D.C. That pollen got to kick my ass last week. It was terrible. Terrible, but better now. Better now. We have a national champion. Congrats to Baylor for whipping that Gonzaga ass last night. That was we're going to get to Mike Smells here in just a second to talk about this great new podcast, Shattered, about the last 20 years of the Knicks. But it just annoyed me because I heard it on the broadcast and then I saw it on Twitter. People making excuses again, you know. 10 minutes into the game. Oh, Gonzaga's so emotionally spent that overtime win over UCLA. They didn't have anything left. Why can't y'all just say they're getting their ass whipped? What's wrong with y'all? It happens. It's sports, man. I mean, you know, sometimes you come out and the other team just whips your ass that day. And that's what happened last night. It doesn't mean Gonzaga's not a great team or they didn't have a great season. It means on Monday, April the 5th, 2021, they got their ass whipped by Butler, by Baylor. Sorry.
Baylor came out just like, we're better than you. We're bigger than you. Yeah. We're stronger than you. We're just going to muscle you. And that's what happened. And that happens sometimes. Again, like, you know, y'all went undefeated and that was nice.
Right.
But it's not like you were nobody's, you know, idea of the damn John Wood in UCLA. You know what I'm saying? Like, y'all had a nice team, man. Y'all took it as far as y'all could go, and you should be congratulated for that.
And maybe if they play tonight, maybe Gonzaga will play better. I don't know. You know, you never know. I'm just saying, stop. I mean, it just makes me angry when people won't acknowledge what's in front of y'all. This wasn't like this was a one-point game the whole game, and they went back and forth, and, somebody made a shot at the buzzer. No, this was beat down. You know, it happens in sports. Sometimes you get beat down, and that's what happened Monday night with Baylor. They just beat Gonzaga point blank. Give them credit. I mean, that's what's so hard about that? Man. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. I just had to get that off my chest. Let's bring in Mike Smeltz. Mike was a producer on, I listened to the first episode this morning, Shattered. The last 20 years of the New York Knicks, Waz, I know this is close to your heart. So. It was extremely good. Chuck D is a narrator. He's one of the executive producer, I think.
Executive producer, narrator. Yeah.
And it was extremely good. Some good stories. I'm old, so I've heard most of them, but I hadn't heard all of them. So there was a couple in there that I hadn't heard. So Mike, thank you for joining us, man. And look, this is, really, really good in terms of going back and kind of re-explaining to people, you know, why the Knicks were good in the 90s. You know, like, they did have a really good team that was a championship level contender, and what went wrong, and what, you know, and you guys started it with episode one. So for people who haven't downloaded yet or subscribed yet, tell them what this series is about.
Yeah, I mean, it's been my life for a year doing this thing. So basically the series is, why have the Knicks not been good? There's other words you could use, but I'll just say not been good for 20 years.
And why have they struggled?
You know, like, we always talk about, I think people always talk about Dolan. You know, they always focus on Dolan, and they focus on, and there's these little flare-ups or big controversies, whatever it is. And rarely, though, do we ever get a full picture of what's been going on at the Garden for 20 years. This is that attempt. We're attempting to tell that story. Why the Knicks haven't been able to sustain success over these 20 years, you know, and we start with the 90s Knicks. And obviously, you know, if, you know, that's not within the 20 year time frame, but we got to start with when things were good.
Yep.
And then you go forward and you learn, you know, we go through all the eras. We go through Isaiah, Phil Jackson. We have a special episode for just the decision, LeBron, you know, we have Kristaps. We have all these episodes about these little different eras. But I wanted to start with the 90s Knicks just again. I mean, like, those teams were awesome. And it's funny when you talk to Knicks fans, and Waz, you know this, it's like, I almost feel like they were underappreciated at the time because they were just never, they could never beat Jordan and the Bulls. They couldn't beat Hakeem and the Rockets. They couldn't beat, you know, and then in the back half of that decade, they didn't get back to the finals until 99 and then got basically blown out by the Spurs. You know, so at the time, it's like disappointing. But if you look back on that era, you're like, oh my God, you know, Knicks fans would die to get back to the competitiveness of the 90s. Don't I mean?
Yeah.
And so this is a fun, it's a fun series overall.
It's no contest, Mike. And honestly, nowadays, every Knicks fan has basically deified Anthony Mason, deified Derek Harper, Greg Anthony, obviously John Starks and Charles Oakley. And, you know, Pat Ewing is clearly the greatest Knick of all time, right? Everybody understands that that was a golden moment in New York Knicks basketball history. But there was definitely, it's funny, I always tell people Knicks fandom is paired, is the two signatures are eternal optimism and complete hopelessness, right? Like it's those two poles where like if you are going up against Michael Jordan every single year, you just know you're not going to get it done. But it's so funny, DA, like as the Knicks have gone from completely competent franchise for 15 years, like one of the most well-run competent franchises in the NBA to what they are now, they've now become eternal optimists where they're celebrating a 500 team as if they just won the World Cup. And you know, so it's those two poles in Knicks fandom.
Yeah, and we try to represent that. Like, you know, I think when we tell people, hey, we're going to do a thing about the past 20 years of the Knicks, you know, people are like, wow, that's depressing.
Nah.
But no, the Knicks, that's what's interesting to me about, I'm not a Knicks fan. I'm from DA land. I'm from outside DC. So not a Knicks fan. But the Knicks have always had like the cycle of hope. You know, it's Marbury, exciting. Isaiah and Marbury come in, Lenny Wilkins. Or Larry Brown, whichever one you like better. Right. And then things fall apart. You know, like you go along down the different eras. Chris Stapps was exciting. Melo, Amare, exciting. Linsanity.
Phil Jackson.
But things blow apart and break apart and combust. Yeah.
And it never lasts that long.
Never
it's
long.
Weird.
Well, and that's
all these eras.
Think about Linsanity. Like, you know, we of course talk about Linsanity. That was 3 weeks, you know?
Exactly. It was literally 3 weeks.
That was like
it was 3 weeks. What?
DA, like in the moment,
it was like a hurricane. In the moment,
did not feel like it. This thing was so all encompassing and engrossing, and just like it was everywhere. It was everything. Linsan, like when you think about it, it's just, you know, a guy who basically was on the fringes of the league finally gets a shot and plays basically at an all-star level for 3 weeks of his life. Yeah. Like it's 3 weeks like of an NBA season is like 15. It's not even 15 games. It's like 10 games.
Yeah. It's like a romance I had at summer camp.
Exactly.
As a little Jewish kid at summer camp, but I meet a little girl, you know, like
we're gonna see each. We're going to see each other when we get home, right?
Yeah. It was like a little romance summer camp. And that's it. But that's like, you know, that. But so, you know, in this series, what's fun about it is like, you know, we spoke to some crazy, wild people. Like, not just, you know, we talked to a lot of the Knicks people. We talked to, in episode one, you get Ewing, you get Van Gundy, Chris Childs, Charlie Ward. You get, like, some of those people. Dave Checketts, who used to run the Garden in the 90s. You know, a big fish in that sea. But also, like, DA, I know you're a Sopranos fan. We talked to Edie Falco in episode four for The Decision.
Oh, my heart.
Because the Sopranos had a role in trying to recruit LeBron. So we talked to Edie Falco. There's just like Andrew Yang, who's running from, you know, he's not shy from a mic, but he's running from there. We got him. So like there's a lot of different pitches we're throwing your way in the series. And you're going to learn about even more than just the Knicks. You're going to learn about James Dolan. Right. And the franchise. So there's a lot going on.
So DA, I want to ask you, because you know, and I don't want to age you, DA, but I was a young pup in 2000, 2001 when Dolan got the team, sort of took over the team. I would love to ask you, as somebody who's clearly active and covering the league and, you know, obviously as plugged in as you are, did Dolan have a rep? Did anybody like have an understanding of what type of cat that he was? Or was it just one of those things where he's like, all right, it's the guy's son is taking over and we'll see.
It's Charles Dolan's kid. It's Charles Dolan's kid's got the team. That's what it was. That's what everybody thought. You know, before the Celtics were sold to the Grosbeck Group that now owns the team. They had they had a similar situation where the father, and the family name was Gaston. I can't remember who was the father and who was the son, but basically it was the same thing. The son got the team and ran it into the ground, and everybody hated the son and wanted him out of there. Please get him out of there. It's very similar to what happened with the Knicks, but the Celtics got sold to a competent group that currently is running it now. So that's the difference, is that Dolan's never copped to selling it. But yeah, I mean, that was the basic, you know, once Cablevision bought the team, it was like, okay, well, Charles Dolan's got a ton of money and they're going to be, you know, do what they always do, which is spend a lot of money. And then, you know, once it was clear that he was not going to be involved in the day to day and it was going to be the son, you know, there's always red flags that go up when the son of a rich man decides he's going to, you know what I mean? Like, it just always. Even going back, you know, when I covered the football team here, and it's completely different because, you know, the Cook family owned the team. Jack Kent Cook owned the team. Late
legends.
His son was John Kent Cook. And John Kent Cook was a very, very nice man. Personally, a great guy. Not a great guy. He was a very polite. He never threw around his money. He wasn't a loud, obnoxious guy. You know, he didn't have anybody escorted from the building for saying he's on the team. You know what I mean? He's a decent human being, but he's still a rich man's son. So there was a lot. That's why, at least partly, I think the team wound up being sold to Dan Snyder. That didn't work out very well either. But this is what happens when you
rich men
wind up with the team.
Yeah, in episode one.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, sorry, my internet's bad here. I'm in Potomac, DA, which you know is up there.
Oh, damn, you in the rich part of town, man. I'm actually getting that expert service.
You talk about this. I live. It's fun. I say I live like two blocks from Dan Snyder, but I do. But we're living in a different style. But we have, and you know, it's funny you bring up the son thing, because like in episode one, one of my favorite parts of it is we have Dave Checketts telling us a story. Dave is about to leave the Knicks, but James Dolan wants to keep him around. At least that's Dave Checketts' recollection of the events. And they're at a company retreat in Sanibel Island, Florida. And James Dolan's a musician, you know, that's his deal. Man. So he gets up on stage.
Of a sort.
Yeah. He gets up on stage at this company retreat. You know, there's all the employees there, and plays a Bruce Springsteen cover song for Dave Checketts. And the song is called I Am Chuck Dolan's Son. And he sings this song. And he says, I don't know when, Davey, you know, we're going to go back to the place we really want to go, like the championship, but never forget I'm Chuck Dolan's son. And I think that's a real perfect encapsulation of the Dolan experience, where it's like, one, it's music. It's the thing he loves. He's trying to be charming. Like in that moment, he's trying to connect with Dave Checketts. But even in the song, he's saying, I am Chuck Dolan's son. So, I mean, it's just he's a fascinating person. And the team, obviously, you know, I talked to a lot of Knicks fans, like, grassroots Knicks fans for the thing. And, you know, people love this team and they want to people just want the Knicks to be good. And so I hope that, but by listening to this thing, maybe we'll figure out a way that could happen. I don't know if that's going to happen. But.
And the crazy thing about Dolan too, that I think about often, is that Dolan is the first owner in the history of the league to put together black coach, black president, black GM. Ever at the same time. Like that's never been done. And James Dolan did that. It's just so weird. Like the kinds of people he attaches himself to, like his thinking when it comes to his hiring and firing practices. Like James Dolan, like nobody else would hire Steve Stout, but James Dolan, like nobody, and let him go on the radio and represent the team and talk about branding and marketing of a freaking basketball team that has struggled to make 500 for 20 years, right? Like he's the only person who would do that kind of stuff. He's just an endlessly fascinating guy to me. I don't know how much you guys get into it in the series, but remember when there was that little brief dalliance where Dolan was like, I mean, I would sell it for like
$10 billion. Like, yo, this guy is such a freaking dick. He's like, he's not gonna sell it, but he wants everybody to know that, like, it's up to me. And if I did, it would have to be for a lot of money. It's just like, he's such a strange cat.
Yeah. So I don't, I mean, the price tag thing is like, you know, we could have that debate, like, how much would it cost to buy the, there's only a few people now in the world that would probably care enough to do it and could do it. And like, it's like the Jeff Bezos types, right? Like, that's basically it. Yeah, no, I mean, we again, it's like, my hope is that people listen to this. They're going to learn things that they've never heard before about the Knicks, about the NBA, and about Dolan. And it's fun. Like, again, I promise, it's not all depressing. It's not all like losing. It's fun. You know, I promise. Even if you're a Knicks fan, you're going to like listening. And if you like this podcast, both Waz and DA are on it. I mean, I had to include Mr. Aldridge, Hall of Famer, because the man carried The Last Dance, if we're going to be honest. So I had to get him in on this one. So, but it's really, like, personally, it's a joy that it's out there, because you know what it's like. You work on something for forever and then you release it. You're excited.
It is called Shattered Hope, Heartbreak, and the New York Knicks, documentary style podcast on the last 20 years of Knicksdom under James Dolan. Mike Smeltzer is the producer of it. Mike, thank you so much for joining us, my man. And, you know, continue good luck. Like I said, the first episode was fantastic, and look forward to hearing the rest of the series.
All right. I appreciate you guys.
Thank you for coming on, Mike. I'm really proud of you. And I'm also proud of myself for my little small role that I played in this thing very early on. So I'm very happy for you. I know you put a lot of work into it, and it's going to be fire, bro.
Appreciate you guys. Thank you, guys.
Let's bring DA into the conversation here.
Welcome to Who
Comma Is
Adjacent on the Athletic Podcast Network.
I turned it on and I heard Shaq with the barbs. It's like the boasting and the braggadocio. I was transported right back into it. I was like, oh, this is great.
I think I rap better than Shaq.
David Aldridge.
Oh, he's totally playing. Yes. Yes. And then he got their lungs out in front of everybody on TV.
Michael was not your friend.
It was popping in
there. Lambre.
So the Chicago and Detroit stuff, that was real.
That was real.
I mean, God forbid we don't have scholarship monies and can't pay for the charters for the water polo in Iowa.
Hoops adjacent.
Welcome to Hoops 5-4. We have ignition.
All right, all right. We're back, and we are joined now by a man with the sweet microphone hookup. Wow, y'all got the sweetness. I'm just plugging shit into my computer and calling it a day. Derek Bodner joins us. All things 76ers, man. Derek, thank you for joining us, man.
My pleasure.
Man, it's good to see you again. And hey, let's talk 76ers. They are in a good position. Relative to the rest of the Eastern Conference, perhaps not relative to the Nets, but we'll talk about that in a second. Let me ask you just about the trade deadline, what you thought they accomplished. Obviously, they were not going to be in the they didn't get into the Kyle Lowry business because the price tag was too high, but they wound up with George Hill. And where do you think that leaves them going into the playoffs?
Yeah, well, I think George Hill is a good addition, but he's not. I don't think he's going to fundamentally change who they are and what their weaknesses are. And I think Kyle Lowry, while maybe not fully changing that, at least gave them a dynamic they didn't have. You know, George Hill, I think, is going to give them a good defender. I think he's going to make open shots. He's been one of the best catch and shoot players in the league the last few years. I think he is going to make some plays off the dribble. He is going to slide into a role that they need. But I still feel like they are lacking a little bit in terms of a perimeter shot creator, to really, give me confidence that they can compete against the Nets and the Lakers and the Clippers when they're at full health. So I think he is a good addition. The price tag was very small, and that's a huge part of this. So I think he was a good pivot when it became obvious that Kyle Lowry is going to cost too much. But I do still feel like they have some issues with their team that drops me down just a little bit on whether or not they're ready to really contend for a title.
So I'm glad you said that, DB, because does that mean that the team is basically comfortable with the idea that in the playoffs, we're going to give Joel the keys and we're just going to basically bet on our ability to bludgeon people to death? Is that the plan?
Yeah. Yeah, and look, Joel has had some struggles in the playoffs, especially in the second round in previous years. I think the East is different this year. You don't have, you know, Marc Gasol and the Raptors and their scheme. You don't have Al Horford to deal with, who he struggled with in his first playoff run. So I think the path through, like, there's nobody you look at and you say, well, that team is going to cause Joel troubles. They have somebody who can match up with them. So I think he will have more success. And also, he's just grown tremendously as a player. So I think that's more viable than it was a couple of years ago. But yeah, outside of that, I'm not entirely sure how they're going to generate offense against some of these elite defenses. You know, you look at them, I think they're right around 13th-ish in offense. They've really struggled here of late when Joel has been out offensively. They've been winning games because of their defense, but offensively they've struggled. And when I do look towards the playoffs, I wonder, well, how are they going to score consistently outside of Joel Embiid post-ups or face-ups in the playoffs? And I think it's a real legit concern.
You know, Daryl Morey has said, you know, at the trade deadline that he wants to make sure that the window is extended for multiple years and it's not just this year. And I just wonder about that because, again, it's I understand the theoretical part of this, which is we want to be good for as long as we can with this core group of Embiid and Simmons. But nothing is guaranteed. Everybody has won ACL from the lottery. Everybody in this league. And so to me, to say, well, we don't want to maximize our chance to win this year with a really good team that is really, you know, poised to win a title because we want to be good 3 years from now. Again, I get it, but I don't know. I worked in Philly long enough to know I'm not sure how much that sells in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But you tell me.
Well, even go back to that 01 team, like you thought that team could be around for a couple of years and they went off a cliff quickly. So this is a city that wants it now. And I think they're a little concerned waiting. You know, I think with Lowry, it was just, you know, you're talking about an older player now. There were reports he wanted to go to Miami in the offseason. He was going to be a free agent. And you look at all that they were asking for, like, would they have traded, you know, a first round pick and Tyrese Maxey and salary filler for Kyle Lowry? Probably. But I think it just became too much where there was so much uncertainty with Lowry, both with how he would continue to age and also with the asking price and whether he would stay in Philly, that he just felt like it didn't make sense. And I get that. But to your point, you know, you never know how long something's going to last. Well, especially when you've got a 27-year-old 7'2" center with a history of foot and knee problems and back problems, you just don't know how long he's going to play at this MVP caliber level. So I think there, and you could go back through Daryl's history. He's made comments in the past. If you have a 5% chance of winning a title, you've got to go for it. He obviously was the one GM who really tried to push the Warriors during their run. So it did seem a little out of character for him. Mm-hmm. But I think if there was something that was just made a little, you could balance a little bit more into a, not just this year, but a 2 to 3 to 4 year window, he probably would have been a little bit more aggressive. But you just don't know how long Joel Embiid is going to be playing at this level. And you don't know how often you're going to get this kind of season. I mean, when was the last time the Sixers had an MVP? It's been 20 years. So, I get that as well.
But see, we can go with what Daryl Morey says, which, you know, when a GM is speaking publicly about the direction he's trying to take his team, there's a little bit of gamesmanship there.
Oh, of course.
Of, I'm willing to stand pat for 4 years with this team. Like, yeah, okay.
You go back to a couple months ago the Harden stuff, and I would never trade Ben Simmons.
Thank you.
Yes, I don't, like, Daryl Morey will say something to my face, and I will know he's lying to me. And that's fine. That's part of the game. Like, we all get it, but yeah, no.
And that's where I was taking it, DB. Like, if I'm Ben Simmons, there's no way I'm like, yeah, I'm locked into this team forever. Like, this offseason, you have to be thinking it's a possibility that I get moved, depending on, you know, how well the Sixers play, how well Ben Simmons plays in the postseason. Yeah. No.
Yeah, 100%. And like, this is a another instance where, you know, Ben has not been good in the second round of the playoffs in various years. There have been coaches, there have been schemes that have taken him out of his flow offensively, made him a bystander at times in the playoffs. And he had a real good stretch leading up to the All-Star break where it looked like he was growing as an offensive player. But I think everybody in Philadelphia is like, okay, but I want to see that in the playoffs. I want to see that when you have the best coaches, the best teams, the best personnel, and when they have 7 games to prepare for your strengths and weaknesses. And he's been struggling here of late. I think a lot of people have some questions whether or not he's going to be a huge factor in the playoffs. And yeah, look, everyone, as a general concept, I don't believe in players being untouchable outside of maybe a select 5 in the league. And Ben Simmons, certainly, like, Daryl Morey will trade anyone he thinks will get him a chance, better chance for a title. Yes. And I think that is something that was certainly on his mind earlier in the season and probably should be in the future too.
Yeah. I mean, I still feel like, you know, if the Wizards change their mind and put Bradley Beal on the block this summer, that to me is like the so obvious move for them to make, you know, and I would assume Simmons would be part of that at some point, you know, whether it's directly to Washington or a three-way or something. But you also wrote about the buyout marker, and there's not a ton of guys left after the first wave, but there's a couple of guys. I think, you know, Olynyk makes some sense for them if he does become available. Does it need to be that kind of stretchy five that can spread the floor a little bit, especially when Embiid's not on the floor
for
that second unit?
It has been it'll probably end up being whoever, like, if there is a viable stretch five, I would be surprised if they go in any other direction. And part of that is because when you're a buyout market team, you have to be attractive to the buyout candidate. And that means playing time. And the Sixers right now have the most playing time as a backup five. Hopefully one who can play a little bit of four alongside Joel as well, allow them to showcase themselves for that next contract. But right now the fit with Simmons and Dwight Howard off the bench has been tough. And Dwight's played well. He's a viable backup center. But the fit, when you have two players on the court who won't shoot outside of 3 feet, that becomes a little tough to navigate. And the offense with those two on the floor has been pretty disastrous. So I would expect that if there is a viable option where they can find a better complement for that, then I would expect that's where they'll go.
You know, the guy that I feel like nobody ever talks about, even though he's making damn near $40 million a year, is Tobias Harris, right? Like, it's just understood and expected that, I don't know, like, that he's not supposed to matter, that he's ancillary, that he's, you know, whatever. But meanwhile, he's their second best scorer. Like, as far as putting the ball in the hoop, it's Joel, and then it's Tobias Harris as far as, you know, getting that done. I think he's played better with Doc Rivers this year. I think for whatever reason, Doc has a good idea about how to put this guy in position to sort of do what he does best. But what can we expect from Tobias Harris in the playoffs? Like, what could he do that would be like, oh, that's disappointing? Because I feel like he doesn't have to do anything. He just has to show up, collect his 40 mil, and go home. It's the best job ever.
Yeah, well, it's funny because if you would zoom out like 5 months ago, 6 months ago, Philly was very, like, they were very hard on him. And I mean, right, like, when you make that kind of money, you put yourself in the crosshairs, so to speak. But he has just come in. He's been the best version of it. Look, he hasn't like completely redefined his game. You're not going to put him in a ton of pick and rolls and ask him to create for others or run your half court offense. But he's just been so much more decisive with his actions. And he's shooting a lot early in shot clocks before defense gets set and taking advantage of matchups. And he has played the best version of Tobias Harris that we've seen. And that's his two best years now have been under Doc Rivers. So certainly I think it's fair to say that he gets something out of him that other coaches just haven't. And because he's been so consistent, he has slid under the radar, and he deserves a little bit more praise than he's been getting. But when you have somebody like Embiid, who's an MVP candidate, and someone like Simmons, who's maybe the most polarizing player in the league, I guess it's natural that you will be overlooked a little bit. And considering what he was going through last year, when everyone was focused on the contract and the fact that he was, you know, hampering their ability to make moves, I guess going under the radar might not be a worst thing in the world.
Along those lines, Derek, how are defenses reacting to Danny Green on the floor this year? Is it still the scramble, go get him, don't stay attached, you know, run him off the line? Or are they more willing to kind of live with his occasional 3-point stroke and not compromise their defense?
Yeah, he's been really good here of late. You know, I think he is somebody who benefits from Simmons being able to push the ball early in transition and the attention that Joel receives. He gets corner threes more than I would expect. I actually think they've been leaving him open and doubling off of him more than I would have expected given his reputation. And he's had a pretty good 3-point shooting season because of that. He started off slow and he was struggling. But over the last month or so, he's been real good. He's, you know, his defense, I think, has taken a step back. He's, you know, getting to that point in his aging curve, but his shot has been good. They've been able to find him in corners And defenses have been leaving him a little bit more than I would expect, which, you know, it would be great if they didn't, because then Joel has more room for post-ups. But if they do, the Sixers have been real good at moving the ball around and finding him. So it's been good.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that because I saw some of it, you know, last year when he was in L.A., the coverages were different than I had seen with him before, especially when he was in Toronto. It seems to me like teams are willing to live with him making four or five threes in a game because it's just more important for them to have another body, you know, to dig in on Embiid and to keep him from destroying them inside out, as opposed to Danny Green hitting the occasional triple. I don't know. And it's fascinating to me because it's not like he can't shoot anymore. Like, he can still shoot, but it's just not front of mind like it was, especially in Toronto and San Antonio with him. So
no, he's hitting 40%. Sixers have four 40% three-point shooters in their start. Most of them are pretty low volume, which is where the struggle comes in. But he's been making his shots, for sure.
You know, obviously, you know, we've all watched the Nets this year do what they're doing. And it's like, all right, who's supposed to beat this damn team when they're doing what they're doing and KD's not even playing, right? So obviously the Nets present a huge problem for anybody who they would face in a potential playoff series. But I'm definitely more curious about Milwaukee because, you know, they've rounded into form. And I think that would be a very interesting clash in the playoffs. What, to your mind, how do you think they even match up against the Milwaukee in the playoffs?
Yeah, it's a real good question. In years past, they have had Embiid guard Giannis, which is fascinating. Where they stick him in the paint and ask him to contest Giannis when he drives. Now they have a few more capable defenders. You know, Ben Simmons, who had struggled against Giannis in years past, I think he defended him pretty well here in their last matchup. They have a couple of guys they can go to. And, you know, Milwaukee will let teams shoot threes, and the Sixers are a reluctant three-point shooting team. And that sort of plays into one of the Sixers' weaknesses. And can Tobias Harris, who right now, for all he's doing offensively, he's only taking like three to four threes a game. Yeah. Would he be comfortable upping that to six or seven if he's given those shots? They would be a great matchup because they sort of play off of each other's scheme like that. But they're certainly overlooked. They're, I guess, the Tobias Harris of the Eastern Conference, where everyone just expects them to win a lot of games. And nobody really has a whole lot of confidence in the playoffs. And look, when you have Brooklyn, again, it's tough to focus anywhere other than Brooklyn with what they're doing. And like you said, even without Kevin Durant, and how the heck do you match up with that team and those, that offensive talent? I think they're overlooked. I think it would be a fascinating playoff series. And I would like to see, can you execute against that scheme? Can you stop Giannis in a 7-game series? That would be a great test.
And another thing related to that, because, you know, they've gone to the playoffs pretty consistently here ever since Embiid has basically come of age. But that was all under the Brett Brown regime. I would love to know what you've seen as the differences in what Doc has brought to the table. And I feel like with Brett Brown, because he was there from the beginning, right? Like, there's a different sort of relationship that he's going to have to Embiid and Simmons specifically, and how he goes about coaching them. Doc comes in with this sort of, you know, this cultural cachet, if you will. Like, I won championships. I've been doing this. I'm respected. What's he been able to bring to the Sixers this year?
Yeah, and I think when you talk about this, even beyond X's and O's or anything like that, they have just been way more consistent in their effort level and their focus than they were in, I don't want to say in previous years, because early Embiid career, like 2017-18, even 2018-19, they were pretty consistently focused. But last year was a huge step back. And I think there was some frustration there with Embiid and his role in the space, again, the offense. And I think that then carried over to their defense. But this year, Doc has had them very consistently engaged and very consistently on point and focused. To the point, I mean, you go back to the Sixers road record last year, and it was incredible how bad they were on the road. And they could really lose to anyone. And you look at, you know, they just had a 10-game stretch without Embiid, and they went 7-3. And they didn't play a lot of great teams. You know, they played the Wizards without Curry and Lakers without LeBron and AD. But those are games that this team on the road and a road trip would have dropped last year just because they didn't have that effort level that they needed every night. So even beyond everything, and you know, I think, you could certainly give Doc a lot of credit for Tobias and the way he's playing. And you can give Doc some credit for Joel and the way that they have continued to expand his face-up game to make him a more diverse threat, although that had started in previous years. But where I would go right from the jump is that they're just way more consistently focused and the effort is there on an almost every night. And I say almost every night because they just had a game against the Grizzlies, which was terrible. It was a back-to-back, so you cut them some slack, but almost every night they are consistently focused.
And where, Derek, do you see the dynamic, the Maury-Doc dynamic? Because it's, you know, two very big personalities.
There. Yes.
And, you know, a I don't want to say a difference of opinion, because I don't think it's that pronounced, but certainly Daryl has a proclivity toward efficiency that he believes in. and you have some inefficient, less efficient players, let's put it that way, currently within the roster and in the rotation. So how is that going so far?
Well, even zooming back beyond that, just some of the shots that they take. Mid-range heavy, very post-up heavy. I think 27th or 28th in the league in three-point attempts. And Doc doesn't seem like he's too interested in trying to push players outside of their comfort zone in that regard. Which, I mean, to be fair, like part of the reason I think Tobias Harris is succeeding is because he's able to make quicker decisions. And part of making quicker decisions is going to what's natural to him, which is that pull-up jumper, that 15-footer, that floater. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. But yeah, this is not Maury Ball by any stretch of the imagination. And it's such a weird dynamic because they hired Doc before they hired Daryl, and Doc and Daryl had worked together, but that was well over a decade ago and was for like one season. And there's just all kinds of weird dynamics. You know, right now when they're winning, everything seems fine and probably is fine. I don't doubt that. You know, we obviously don't have as much access to see their dynamics behind scenes as we would in other years. You know, I think where we'll find out is when, if they disappoint in the playoffs or if they really have a change in terms, like Doc goes out and finds some players to play more his style of play, you know, will Doc be willing to bend a little bit in that regard? But look, they're both under long-term contracts. Everything has been great for so far this year. Like I said, though, those kind of relationships get tested more when stress and failures in the playoffs happen. So we will see how it changes.
Yeah. I mean, with Maury, it doesn't feel like he's ever been too like harsh on any coaches. I think Harden was kind of sick of Kevin McHale, and so they made a move. But I thought Mike D'Antoni sort of got leeway to do his thing. And obviously, a lot of their stuff was aligned philosophically.
Yeah. I mean, Mike D'Antoni certainly agreed with a lot of Daryl philosophically. Yeah.
But, you know, but the thing about Doc is I don't think he's anti-three. He just doesn't care. You know, right. I remember at a game last year, I asked him about Kawhi. Kawhi wasn't really taking any threes whatsoever. And Kawhi's a damn good shooter, right? And I was like, you know, Doc, have you talked to Kawhi about upping his attempts? So he's like, no, why? He's making the shots he takes. I was like, okay, fair enough.
And I mean, that's the stance he takes with Ben Simmons. He doesn't care if he shoots or scores as long as he plays defense and facilitates. Stance he takes with Tobias Harris and getting him back into those shots. So yeah, that is definitely I would say he doesn't care too much as long as he feels like the offense is flowing well. And I think Daryl might have a slight difference of opinion on that, but we will see how that plays out over time.
Are they, you know, you're both right about the Nets kind of taking all the oxygen out of the room. And I wonder if the Sixers feel better kind of being out off the radar a little bit this year. I definitely think that helps Milwaukee, for example. I don't think Milwaukee responded well last year when they were clearly, like everybody thought Milwaukee was the team to beat in the East and they were the clear favorite. And I think they kind of didn't like that. And I wonder if Philly feels better kind of being off the pace a little bit while all the attention is in Brooklyn or not.
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say probably, you know, just because I think Joel is... It's so weird that Joel Embiid, who in previous years we thought thrived off of the fans and that interaction and that energy, and that was part of their struggles on the road, was that he didn't have that to boost his energy level, has had his most consistent season in a year where there's been no fans. And I do feel like there's a focus that he has had specifically, and so much of the Sixers, you know, their direction is somewhat dependent on Embiid. But he has been so focused and so consistent that I do wonder if maybe, like you said, everybody talking about Brooklyn, everyone talking about the LA teams, has allowed him to just be a little bit more consistent and flat in years where he otherwise, if the Sixers were running away with the East, and even though the Sixers have been number one in the East for most of the season, there is still, like you said, the oxygen out of the room that goes directly to Brooklyn. And I think it might be fair to speculate that that has helped them be a little more consistent. Yeah.
Has Joel been the MVP of the league when he's been on the floor?
At that point, I would have voted for him for MVP. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. When you start looking at the splits of when he's, you look at sort of like the overall package, the advanced statistics, the Sixers record, the splits when he's on the floor, what he does defensively. And that defensively is really, I think, what separates him. But that being
certainly
said,
from like, Nikola Jokic.
Yeah. Fair. But he's been incredible, and I would have no problem voting for Jokic now, especially with the missed games. Yep. I think he's been better than LeBron. Yep. That's tough to say because everyone knows when the playoffs start, LeBron's LeBron. But I think this was a year where he was, when you factor everything in, I think he was, if not one, then two or three for sure.
Am I wrong, or is he also not on social media as much this year as he's been?
Not nearly as much as he has been. And that's, I would say that sort of started, honestly, that started after he got into a fight with Karl Anthony Towns at the start of the previous season. Okay. And he went on social media and maybe said some things he shouldn't have. And I think the team came down on him pretty hard. And his social media activity has been cut back since then. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's maturity or if that's just like you said, the team just telling him, hey, knock the shit off, you know?
Well, I mean, I think he probably didn't want to be a distraction, and he's maybe a little bit maturity and, but he's definitely on it way less.
So,
which to be honest, he was entertaining. So I miss that a little bit.
I loved him on social, but I do think it may have been a bit of a distraction.
Yeah.
So
for sure,
DB,
for sure.
And I'm not just saying this to puff smoke up your ass because you're our colleague and you're dope at what you do. I really think you're the best person on the Sixers because not only just because of the work you do and understanding how they're performing, but you also, you never jump out the window with anything you're going to say about the team that you're covering, right? So you're not going to be, you know, because I grew up in New York, I know what it's like for somebody who's covering the team to be very pessimistic at all times.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you got the people who just will never not be optimistic about what the team is going to do. And I think you do a great job.
So you're saying I'm consistently boring.
No. I think you're consistently fair. So, what should we realistically expect out of this team this season in the playoffs, right? Like that we don't come out and say, wow, that was a major freaking disappointment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for this team, I feel like home court is more important than anyone. Not only because you get home court, which is obviously huge. And, you know, when we're talking, you know, the season is about a month later than normal seasons. So at that point, we could have significant fans back in the stadiums. The Sixers did feed off of that in previous years, but also you don't have to beat both Brooklyn and Milwaukee, and that would be huge. So when you talk about like what would be a disappointment, well, part of that is do they play Milwaukee in the second round or do they play a very struggling Boston team or someone else? You know, I think they can beat, certainly if they lose to anyone other than Milwaukee or Brooklyn, that would be a huge disappointment. Milwaukee, I would honestly give them right around a 50-50 chance, assuming health. I think those two teams are pretty evenly matched and they both have playoff struggles, which would make both teams pessimistic. In some cases, rightfully so. The Nets, I do think, are a better team. You know, losing to the Nets, if it's a close series, I don't think that would be a disappointment. Or, well, it'd be a disappointment. I don't think that would be disappointing in terms of their performance. I probably look at everything in terms of like odds. I would give them a 18% chance of winning the East, something in that range. Like, I don't think they are a favorite at this point.
All right, so everybody who's listening, DB just said conference finals a bust for this team.
I think that's fair.
A second round exit would, I think, lead to some changes and certainly a lot of angst for sure.
How many fans are in now?
3,100.
Not bad.
15%. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And they, Pennsylvania should be ramping up their vaccinations pretty quickly here. So I do wonder in like a month and a half, what that will look like.
Okay. All right.
Fingers crossed.
Derek, we appreciate it, man. Love your coverage as always. I agree with Waz. It's terrific day in and day out. And you have a pulse of it like nobody else. And man, safe travels and safe non-travels or whatever you're doing, man. you know, stay safe.
I never thought I'd be like, man, I want to live out of a suitcase again, but I'm looking forward to that. Same to you guys. Right? And I appreciate it.
All right, man. Thank you, Derek. All right, y'all. Well, look, leave that 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, wherever you get this program. And as we always say, if you have less than a 5-star review, keep it to yourself. All right. Later.
All right.